Hello, everybody, and welcome. It's very nice to see you again. I think it was 2 days ago I met Radha Swami at the BI with Brahma Tirtha, and it was a very interesting is not the right word, challenging discussion. The day before that, I had spoken to some of his people who were working on his ecological village. He's got this absolutely fantastic project above Mumbai. It is just the most wonderful project I've ever seen. And I was speaking with some of his people about the logistics, or the actual value or importance of, or obstacles created by the cow protection program they had. And we really got into it on the deepest levels and tried to make sense of it. They're very intelligent people, and it was a lot of fun, that conversation. And the next day when I was talking with Radha Swami, it's his project, we spoke about that briefly, and the real issue there was the utilization of intelligence, of reasoning and rationality, to question and understand the actual value of things, the vision behind things, and the practical implementation of it, whether it's possible or not, over the long term. Now, that conversation ran its course, and then we started talking about ISKCON, because whenever you're with ISKCON people, especially old friends, like I've known him for 55 years. So when you start talking, you ultimately get to, well, what's wrong in ISKCON and how can we make it better? It's just the way it is. Because everybody wants it to get better. Anywhere you live, anywhere you interact with others, your social contacts, your entire livelihood, the what you do and why you do it, you always want it to be better. Now for me, every time I'm forced, actually, because I don't naturally want to do it, every time I'm forced to discuss how to make it better, I ultimately end up in the same place. There has to be a sustainable, practical, compatible vision that encompasses all the people within the society, and it has to be managed by those who really have the brain to figure it out. And then, ultimately, we start talking about, quote-unquote, the intelligent class of men. And really, that belongs in quotes, and I'll tell you why. Because obviously you need to have brain to figure out how to manage and organize and make things work. But I always bring up the point that when Prabhupada was on his deathbed in Vrindavan, he said 50% of his work wasn't done, and he wanted to institute Varnashram to make up for that lacking. Because even if you had very intelligent people managing everything, it wouldn't be able to be implemented properly because you don't have the other personalities who are fitting very well in the different Varnas, because all of them together are required to make things work, not just some brain. So, a conversation that revolves around finding the most intelligent people to figure this out always breaks down. And I have to end up speaking about boring things like, well, the whole thing by definition cannot work. Doesn't matter, you have whatever body in charge. By definition, this cannot work because you lack the elements of a society to make it work. So I engaged in a lot of blah, blah on that theme. But I was really dissatisfied, really uncomfortable. Next day, basically depressed. And then I have to speak to you. So I need to have something to talk about. As usual, the deities help very much. And then I realized what the problem is in my understanding or of my expression at the BI. It's this very sticky word, intelligence. Especially if you say the intelligent class of men. Now, what does that mean? If you don't question it very much, if you look at it on face value, you could say, well, it's the brahmanas. And what does that mean? I mean, sure, brahmanas are pujaris, and brahmanas may teach, and brahmanas may, you know, live in the forest. It's not necessarily a manifestation of intelligence. When you put all of the responsibility to make a society work and have that brain defined as the intelligent class of men, it becomes very complex, very fast. So I, as usual, looked up some research on intelligence. And everything that I felt, all my doubts, all my wondering how anybody could possibly nail this down, has already been addressed by like the American Psychological Association. And they gave a great consensus paper. They made a paper that was a consensus of various ideas, various opinions, various forms of research. And this consensus fit within their understanding as the Psychological Association representing psychologists in America. And they wrote not a definitive answer to the problem, not a absolute, undeniable definition of the word. They wrote about the concept and its vastness when you're dealing with human beings. We all differ from one another in our ability to understand complex ideas. We differ in our ability to adapt effectively to our environment. We all learn differently from our experience. Some people are better at using reasoning than others. And we have differences in how we're able to overcome obstacles by thinking and figuring it out. And not only that, but the same person will not be consistent in the way they act in different circumstances, with different surroundings. They will be acting differently, and all those criteria will manifest differently in the same person. And if you judge them according to different criteria, how they manifest, how they seem to be intelligent or not, changes. So when we speak about intelligence, we're just trying to clarify these ideas. We're trying to organize this complexity of phenomena that surrounds the human consciousness and how it works to make things better. They asked 24 different theorists, prominent theorists, to define intelligence. They got 24 different answers. Now let's go back to the intelligent class of men. If the intelligent class of men cannot even figure out what is the intelligent class of men, how are we supposed to do it? So then they have these like measurement sticks, like the IQ test. But the IQ test is actually something that is more, shall we say, related to people who are specifically able to thrive in academic contexts. So nowadays, psychologists agree that this IQ test measures some aspects of human intelligence. Then you got three other measurements: emotional intelligence, social intelligence, moral intelligence. I think these three are very much related to what we would consider our brahminical qualities. Shouldn't a brahmana be kind to all living entities? Shouldn't a brahma feel empathy? Shouldn't a brahma try to assist and help wherever a brahmana can? Shouldn't a brahmana act within the society to try to arrange the social situations for the benefit of everybody and to be a compatible member of the society in that way? And shouldn't a brahmana be understanding of morality, to understand the difference between right and wrong, to understand how to behave? Now, I know Elon Musk is low-hanging fruit, very easy target, but I got to use him anyway. He's a great example. In some ways, the man is actually absolutely brilliant genius, can create things which are mind-blowing. Of all the things he's creating, I think his Optimus robots are going to be the most successful, most interesting in due course of time. I mean, the guy's got like an academic brain, which is phenomenal. He's got children all over the place from all kinds of people. He neglects them. So many of them can't stand him. He's just a not very good parent. And his latest endeavor in fixing government caused everybody to not like him at all. So, intelligent class of men. I know some really intelligent guys, super brainy, unbelievable intellectual capacities, who have zero emotional intelligence. So if our archetypical intellectual intelligent class of man that we have to find is someone who has academic brain, IQ, capacity to reason, capacity to figure things out, emotional, social, and moral intelligence, then we really got somebody there. We have the composite required to fit the criteria. Sounds great. How in heaven's name do you quantify these qualities? How do you find such a person? And to what degree must each of these intellectual qualities exist? Who's going to judge it? Who's going to say this person meets the criteria? I've seen incredibly intelligent, academically qualified people have no ability to judge or understand, for example, emotional intelligence or social intelligence. Is it possible even to test these things? And then when somebody is great in all of it, they get a certificate. I don't think so, because it's not testable in kind of like a written environment. Let's say you're a teacher, right? I mean, a really, really qualified teacher, and you've got children who are growing up in front of you. You have the perfect perspective to understand the qualities of these kids. First of all, you're seeing them in everyday action. And second of all, the issues and difficulties and obstacles they're experiencing are not that serious. So from the adult point of view, looking at this, they have a very great perspective to understand the quality of these children. And for example, over a 20-year period of time, by the time they mature, individuals can be pointed out to be nurtured to fit very important positions in society. Because you've observed it, you've seen it in practical action. You can't cheat practical action over time. And as you get older, as these children get older, the situations they are in get more complex. They're no longer simplistic as they were when they were small children. It's more complex. It has more significance, the choices they make. And because you've seen them develop, you get a really good impression of who they are and therefore what they can become. This is called generational development. Doesn't happen overnight. It happens over multiple generations of a sustainable organic methodology within the family structure. This is actually the Varnashram system. I mean, obviously not the entire thing, but this is the way in which the different members, the very qualified leading members of society, are assisted and facilitated to enter the different aspects of society. So potential leaders within each of the Varnas who are actually modeling, who are actually inspiring, who are actually assisting the entire society to grow and develop, come from these generational nurturing environments. Okay, we figured out everything. That's it. Finished. Period. Well, no. Let's come down off the clouds of theoretical perfection and let's go back to where we are right now. We're back to that very slippery, oily, gripping, zoop right out of your grasp intellectual class of men, intelligent class of men. We're back there with the quotes around it. So here's this body of people in charge of stuff, and it is assumed that they're good for the job. Why? Were they measured for their IQ? Were they systematically observed for their emotional, social, and moral intelligence in various challenging situations? Nope. They were just, you know, they needed somebody over there. They were there. They've been there for a while. They may have some position already. Somebody says, hey, that's a good guy. Nobody knows whether that's a good guy or not, but they need a guy and they don't want to bother arguing about it. So they say, sure, let's get that guy. So, you know, when people ask me, well, what would you do if you could? I mean, I hate that question. First of all, I can't. Second of all, I wouldn't anyway do it. So the question, what would you do if you could, is like, I hate strawberries, right? You don't know that. I can't stand strawberries. And I'm a vegan, and that's just no, I'm really a strict vegan. So somebody hands me a bowl of strawberries and cream and says, eat that. And I'm going to go inside, blah. But I'm in a social context, and there are expectations, and you don't want to insult anybody. So you end up having to eat this absolute junk. So that's why I'm giving this lecture, because I don't like strawberries and cream. My conclusion is, you're stuck. Think about that. You have inherited stuckness. You have generational stuckness. Let's go back to the cow discussion, okay? I asked this devotee, I asked this really smart person. So I asked him, I said, well, why are you doing it? And with no enthusiasm in his voice and no conviction in his voice, he said, because my Guru Maharaj said Prabhupada wants us to do this, so therefore we're doing it. Okay, it's not nice of me to expose him in that way, but isn't that interesting? You got lots of cows, but you can't allow them to make milk because you can't have more cows because you have no place to put them, so you can't take care of them, so you're just going to take care of cows as pets. Generational stuckness. So the problem with guys like me is that I look at stuckness and I say, why? Why do you want to embrace being stuck? And the reason I don't like to be engaged in that discussion is because the answer is, one, that's the way we always do it. Two, that's what we've been told to do. And three, nobody would accept anything else. And what's weird is I get it. I get why you think that way. I get that you think there's nothing you can do about it. I get that you have no desire to make any changes. I get that. Yet people look from all points of view, all kinds of people all over the place, and they say, that's not working. This isn't working. That's not right. That's not right. Then they look at the, here go the quotes again, intelligent class of men and say, fix it. But they have no capacity to fix it. They don't have that skill and capacity and ability and reasoning and understanding when something's fundamentally wrong. Because to get into that intelligent class of men status, you have to embrace the stuckness. Tough stuff. So when people ask me, you know, what would you do? How would you do? You know, what should be? I mean, like, you know, leave me alone, please. It's like you go in a kitchen and they're cooking something really weird, using all the wrong ingredients. And then they ask you, well, how do we make it better? And I say, well, use that and this and that. And they go, no, we can't. Well, why should I bother? And the easiest way to deal with people like me is to simply say, no relevance to our situation. I get it. It's true. I am not relevant to the stuckness. So that's why I was depressed on Friday. And that's why I'm not depressed on Saturday. Because I finally woke up and realized, what is going on? I mean, obviously, it's not the first time, but it's like an ongoing, continuous process where I try to be of service. I try to assist. And then the whole thing just tumbles into something. I don't know how I'm feeling. And then I get depressed. And then I recover. And then I try to be of service. And then I try. And at the same time, I'm getting older. Duration of life, limited. And then I think about that. Well, what about when I'm gone? Will it matter? And then I think, well, everybody gets what they endeavor to get. I mean, you know, what they deserve according to their desires and their choices. And that's just life. And I'm okay with that. Just don't give me strawberries and cream. I should call this lecture Strawberries and Cream. People will think that's madness. Yeah. Okay. We'll take a break. You can ask your usual very intelligent questions. And if you don't ask very intelligent questions, I will chastise you severely. Okay. See you in a little bit. Okay. I'm here. I mean, that's obvious. Mahazer. Wait, I'm a little confused about the questioning here because the first question doesn't seem to be listed. And what is number one seems like number three. Hang on. Patty, did you see the first question? This is from Maxime to everyone, 1204. Oh, it's there as number two? Okay, no problem. So number one, dear Hari, do you think it's really possible to build a community of mystics who can inspire each other and together gradually develop the quality of intelligent people? Oh, this is an interesting question. Or are mystics loners by nature because they want to connect and be less social? Well, I don't think that's the way to say it. If we are less social by nature and like solitude, why should we bother? We can't fix the world. I guess you mean divine connection, not with other people. If we are less social by nature and like solitude, why should we bother that we can't fix the world? Maybe we can just help ourselves and some amount of people, happily embrace the divine, and gradually get fit to move to another dimension where things are much better. Interesting question. Well, that's really an interesting thought. Are mystics loners by nature? What would that mean? I can't honestly say, or even dishonestly say, that I know. I can't speak for everybody everywhere. But we can analyze that a mystic's discipline of development to get to the point where they're powerful enough to actually do all kinds of stuff is a personal journey, maybe done together with a significant teacher, or maybe inspired by some form of nature or some other individual. But once the mystic has developed his or her capacity, does that mean they remain someone who is a loner? I don't think so. There are many groups of mystic yogis who live together, who associate with each other. In the modern world, there are societies and associations. There are those who meet on different platforms, not necessarily the physical. But then there's another question. Are these individuals, shall we say, more motivated by self-interest than by group interest? Would they have emotional and social intelligence? And that boils down to each and every individual. I don't believe you can say mystics fit all into this category. So even within the mystic category of person, there are differences amongst them. Some are more socially interested, some are less. So therefore, I would say that if you want to build a community of mystics, you have to find those who are socially aware and socially interested. And if you could, well then yes, you would be able to create such a community. So that's my answer to that question. Number two, I know from my own experience how difficult it is to get out of a state of being stuck. The other day, I thought that a reboot might help of communication, activity, habits, etc. What would you advise? Well, reboot. We're talking about two things here. I was talking about an institutional stuckness. And you're speaking about a personal stuckness. So I'm going to set aside all the discussion about the institutional stuckness and deal specifically with the personal stuckness that you're asking. An individual who feels stuck has a much greater potential to break free from that situation with great effort, but they can do it. You know, when writers or artists end up in a funk, it means they can't figure out how to be creative anymore. They're kind of completely blank. They got a block. They feel stuck. There is advice what they should do. For example, walk backwards. If you're in a city, get out. Go in the forest. Talk to somebody you would never talk to. If you're always going right, go left. Do everything backwards that you usually do. And it can work. So yes, there, I guess you could call it a rebooting. It's kind of like a reprogramming of the consciousness, because the consciousness gets stuck in particular patterns. And by creating new patterns, you're breaking that mold of patterns. I mean, that actually can work. So try it. Okay. There's a comment from Jayanti. I mean, I just read it to myself. It's long, but it's actually interesting. Number three, because she didn't have a question. Number three, in general, to accept any Varnashram system, people must understand its importance. This is not meant in the sense of benefit to society, but in the sense of personal spiritual benefit. That's true. Life is quite short, and one wants to use it with maximum benefit for one's spiritual development. What to do in this situation? It is clear, that it is difficult with varnas. What about ashrams? Now let's say the ashram of householders, that is, the concept of family, is gradually disappearing and acquiring strange forms. And the most interesting thing is how in our time to accept the ashram of hermit or ashram of sannyas, which in principle are important part of varnashram system, meaning not formal samadhi, as in most, but real renunciation. Yes, I think I think that putting the onus or putting the focus of accepting a Varnashram ideal is meant to give personal benefit is a wise thing to do, because generally people don't do things for idealistic reasons. I mean, not for long. If there's a personal reason to do it, if there's personal benefit involved, yes, it's easier to embrace. So I would suppose if one is interested in personal development, that person can find a way to amplify their particular qualities to accomplish their spiritual goals and live very comfortably within the materialistic existence that we're all forced to live in, meaning the structure of existence here in this world. Now, as far as ashrams go, well, yes, family is gradually disappearing. Yes, that's true. And it is a problem. Yes, it is. It's too much to talk about that now, but I like the idea that one of the most important principles is a form of renunciation that is dependent on dropping attachments in this world. So I think that learning to be detached, which is actually a major aspect of the ashram existence over time, detachment, is an essential principle, fundamental principle of spiritual development. I'm not exactly sure if that's the answer or the comment that is desired, but that's the best I can do with what I got. Number four, are there varnas in the afterlife or in the world of gods or in the spiritual world? Well, gopis and gopas are Vaishnavas. When Krishna was here, he acted like a king, Dwarka. So it's complicated. In the spiritual world, do we have varnas? Do we have divisions of labor to do things? Yeah, I guess. I mean, the spiritual world is probably the supreme organization. In the celestial realms, definitely you have Brahman is, for example, cursing Indra. Indra's the king. In the celestial world, you've got those who take care of the those who are in that kingdom. There is all kinds of people who are also divided in these various tasks and capacities. It's just natural. You can't avoid it. It's just normal in all kinds of life. Number five, we live on a stuck planet. Everyone is stuck in their time, place, circumstances, even intellectuals. They're just ready to see the meaning in their enjoyment of strawberries with cream. And it is so sweet that every proposal to take a step into the new and unknown is frightening. Let someone else do it, and we'll put it in the jam when we accept it. Inventiveness and a way out of the intellectual capacity, in my view, can be scientists, artists, and crazy people. Sometimes it is a blessing, sometimes a curse. I believe that Krishna has something to do with it. It looks like the game Jumanji? To me, I would like to do a lesson about scientists. That is about those who think and see things that way. I don't have a question, just inspiration. I'm currently living in a country where young people are creating a revolution to move generational stuckness. It's hectic and it's interesting. Who knows how to watch and participate? So that's a good question. That's a good comment, not a question, as it's stated. So we just read it. Number six, I'm not sure if this is a correct question, but I'll ask it anyway. Tell me, if possible, what did you advise in connection with this situation with the cows? Well, what I said was I don't think that this should be a priority in any way. I don't think it's practical. I don't think there's any ultimate value for non-generational farmers or people who take care of animals. I don't think that accepting this as a primary ingredient in family life or in social life is required. It's archaic. I don't have any answer for the huge herds of non-productive cows they have already. I can't speak about that. There's no solution. Although Radhana Swami brought up the point that if people go and they, in his place, and they brush the cows and spend time with the cows, they realize what beautiful creatures they are. They realize what incredible consciousness they have and how it rubs off on them themselves. And therefore, it helps people to develop empathy and to absolutely give up meat eating. I thought that was nice, and that is certainly a good engagement for people when they're near the cows. Number seven, you've already spoken about inertia. The environment is not ready to accept changes because people live by inertia. They are doing well and they do not want to change anything. The same can be said about the whole society. The whole society is stuck because those at the top are doing well and they do not want to change anything. While in the middle and bottom of society, it is getting worse and worse because the top is parasitizing, that's not a word. The top is acting like parasites on the whole society. And here, perhaps, we can only talk about a revolution from below, when, for example, people organize against the inaction of local authorities, or when vegans carry out actions on cattle farms, or when in Europe, farmers and migrants organize mass demonstration. That is, some kind of chaos is brewing from which another, more developed society will later form based on the already existing informal leaders of various communities. Whew. Well, I think that the question is its own answer. And that change often has to come from underneath, organically, but that's rare. It doesn't often happen, but it does happen. And I know that a lot of people are thinking exactly like this now. What I can say is I hope so. But like I said, the question is its answer. People are wondering what I meant, strawberries and cream. I guess it's, I'll explain. I meant that I don't like strawberries and I don't eat cream. So if somebody gives me a bowl of strawberries and cream and I'm in a situation where I have to eat it, I'm not going to like it. So if somebody's asking me, you know, what would I do if I were to change everything and fix everything and do everything, I don't like talking about that. But I'm in this situation where I have to address it. That's what I meant. I probably used a terrible example. Just forget it. It wasn't worth it, the example. Number 9, is it possible to combine the two aspects of worship of the Lord and care for the devotees within a society of devotees of different social status? The question is not about castes, but about a social system that does not humiliate one, that does not tolerate the humiliation of one by the other. I mean, sure, of course, it is possible. I mean, that is just the way society in the Vedic times went on. Obviously, you have devotion to the deity and everybody taken care of within the society according to their capacities and requirements. This was the normal way in which things were. So, yes, it is possible. Whether or not we can do it now depends on how good we are. And number 10, wouldn't it lead to more chaos to try to create Varnashram in our crazy world? It would be something perhaps like the caste system in India. I never said we should create Varnashram in this world. So I don't, because I don't believe it's possible to institute that. You can't even institute that in ISKCON, where everybody was told they should institute that by Prabhupada so many times. I don't believe it's going to happen. But, if you can establish these generational forms of education and development of individuals, it will just gradually unfold over due course of time. You don't have to struggle to create. It will just unfold because it is natural for people to fall into these various categories. Last question. Number 11, isn't it more easy to define oneself as Atma who is not a member of Varna Ashram? Sure. Just spiritual me without a definition and do the best service with full compassion to others? Sure. But that wasn't the point of this lecture. And with that, I say goodbye. I say thank you very much. You've been great as usual. And much love to all of you, and great health and great success and great happiness.